this episode of The Ramble, we meet up with Richard Norris to hear about his memoir of a lifetime in music, Strange Things Are Happening. The book spans the entirety of Richard's career, from an early pivotal meeting with John Peel via the birth of Acid House to Californian adventures with Joe Strummer. But Strange Things Are Happening is much more than just a series of anecdotes. At its heart are a series of reflections on 40 years of creative practice, a lifetime of collaborations and innovations in music that have brought countless people together. It's written with grace, never shying from accounts of relationships imploding or ideas that don't make it. But above all else, there's a deep sense of love here for the creative act. There was so much to ask Richard about, but we chose to start where the book does, in an idyllic early 70s childhood that seemed to feed into everything that came after.
There's something about, you know, time's different at that point. The summers just did stretch on forever, you know. I mean, between those ages of like 3 and 5 before I had to go to school, I was just out in this kind of woodland from about, you know, early summer till autumn. Well, certainly I got a very good appreciation of kind of stillness and space and sounds as well. I mean, I was really aware of, you know, any kind of twig cracking on the floor or something like that, kind of, oh, right, there's a fox over there. And, you know, just had that kind of sort of the spatial aspects of that. And also being on your own, you know, kind of like my brother was at school, my mum was sort of in the house and my dad was at work. You know, I was really alone at that point. But I kind of like it, you know. I got very self-sufficient in a way, really, even if their self-sufficiency was only building some kind of weird den or catching butterflies or chasing moles for hours. Something about time expanded in that place, and there was definitely an affinity for nature, and just the forest in particular. It really felt like it was watching over me. I kind of had a real feeling of that. I'm not really a fan of those early bits of books. I always want to get straight to the action, you know, but people seem to really like it. It was the bit that wasn't sort of, didn't really know how that would go down, but people, you know, because it's a very different style of writing, but people seem to like it.
I was thinking while I was reading this that people are writing memoirs now that straddle the emergence of the internet. Mm. And one of the things that I loved about the book was its account of analog culture. You had to physically seek it out. Can you talk a bit about your experience of engaging in music in that way, the DIY, the punk aspect of it?
A lot of it was chance and luck and opportunity that kind of happened after punk. I mean, just the idea of us trying to make a record 5 years before that would be impossible. I mean, you just couldn't do it. You'd have to sort of sign to a massive label or like have, you know, really, or gigged for years. But suddenly just this kind of combination of sort of punk rock do-it-yourself attitude and development of the, you know, distribution network with Rough Trade and Small Wonder and all these other shops, Probe in Liverpool and, you know, places all around the country. I mean, that suddenly gave us a bit of a platform. And I think being really young, I mean, there's a local clipping of my band, the Innocent Vickers, in the Arts Advertiser. And it's like the Innocent Vickers average age 13. And it's kind of like, it's really strange. You know, that was sort of acceptable and normal, and that people didn't just shut the door, you know. It was their doors just opened, you know, and through just a great support network that had kind of been there really since the 60s. I mean, you know, there was a great, you know, local promoters and people putting stuff on in pubs, and, you know, the one guy that was used to be a musician but he wrote for the local paper and stuff. And it was just this kind of support system. But, you know, we would like writing to the Clash and they'd write back, which is just phenomenal. It's just you know, you get a letter back from Paul Simonon or something. It was really quite a good thing. But I think there was a lot of luck and just a lot of kind of passion and wanting to be involved just through listening to John Peel and reading the music press.
That, I think that was one of my favorite passages early on in the book, this bit where you hand your record over to John Peel, and then you kind of, over the next kind of couple of weeks, you hear it getting played out on radio. But I'm having to remind myself when I'm reading it that you were 15 when that's happening. What was the importance of having an early champion like that?
I think that's what made me still make records and make music and produce stuff today. I mean, it's very much that one day when we went to Rough Trade and they bought all the copies and then of the record and paid for it out the till, and then going to John Peel and you know, actually talking to him, someone that, you know, that was quite a distant figure, you know, that with, you know, national radio, it's kind of a big deal, you know. And that was the one day that really set me on the path to do music. And I just thought, right, this is what I want to do, which It's a mixture of passion and obsession, I think, really is the things. But John Peel, I mean, particularly, you know, having 2 hours of radio every night that everyone listened to under the bedclothes, and you know that everyone else is got their transistor radio half volume in case their parent tells them to turn it off around the country. You know, that's, you know, that's an extra 8 hours a week, you know, of schooling, basically. You know, it's an extra day of school, really. And people, everyone was really obsessed by it, you know. And it made we made, and it also there's something about listening to radio where you don't really know what's coming up next, but you'll kind of give it a go, you know. You're kind of a see what happens. And that, you know, obviously in the age of sort of Spotify playlists and kind of AI and the sort of streaming companies giving you the songs that they think that you're going to want to hear because of the other ones that you've had, and these ones are a bit similar. I mean, it's really not like that when you're listening to, like, you know, Scraping Fetus off the Wheel, going into you know, some mad old blues track, going into Jarshaka or something. I mean, it's sort of, you just get that mix. And I think that was a really, really important thing. I mean, particularly things like dub reggae. I mean, kind of, I really took me a long time to get that on John Peel. I was just thinking, God, this is really boring. There's not really much going on. It's very repetitive. But after a while, I started to really get it, and just really enjoy it. And you know, it was really was an education. It was a proper public service broadcasting, and I'm absolutely grateful for that. You know, just the fact that there weren't that many outlets, there was only a few papers and a few radio places that you could go to, kind of really did focus everyone. At that point between sort of after punk, really, you know, from about 1978, 1979 into the early 80s was such an amazing time, because it's, you know, we were kind of given license to do it ourselves. And that kind of created all kinds of strange, different types of music, you know, that were given what equipment we had and what our influences were. And it's great, because it just wasn't that kind of, you know, one, two, three, four nihilism of punk. It was a real expression of creativity throughout the UK and beyond. You know, it was an amazing, amazing time. So I think for me, that sort of, you know, I kind of really started to get known for making music in during more kind of acid house and beyond. But for me, that really early stage, being, you know, it's probably 15, 16, 17, that was a really pivotal thing. Yeah, I think a lot of my sort of optimism and kind of belief in creativity and people doing it themselves, a lot of it was to do with that kind of timing and growing up in that era at, you know, a pivotal age, really.
Yeah. There's a continuous joy in finding new things that kind of threads through the whole of the book. So I guess kind of fast forwarding through that period a bit, like you start club nights, you begin working for a record label, co-found and write for the magazine that the book takes its title from. And there's this steady stream of writers and artists that you're meeting, like Alan Moore, the novelist Kathy Acker, and musicians like Genesis P. Orridge, who you end up working with. And I was wondering if we could kind of pause at that point, because this culminates in some impromptu recording sessions. Could you set out a bit, Richard, about how and why those sessions came about and what they led to for you?
I think it's another kind of example of sort of opportunity and serendipity, really, is in that, you know, we were working on this magazine, Strange Things Are Happening, and went to interview Genesis P. Orridge, and he was really interested in our psychedelic label, Vampirouzo. So he had kind of had this idea of, I think he was calling it hyperdelic or hyperdelia. He just wanted to create something sort of psychedelic within kind of modern music. And it was just the timing was great. He just said, "Oh, you know, do you know about acid house?" And I hadn't heard of it at all, but I just love that idea of creating a kind of psychedelic dance music. And he hadn't heard any of the records either. So we just had the name and the word and the idea, you know. So and then just through you know, Jen's kind of creativity and spark, we just went and made a record. He just said, "Right, let's go and make a record next weekend," you know. And so it was partly that opportunity, but also partly the technology. I mean, you know, so you know, even though you can only like sample like a second and a half or something, but it was enough to for us to go, well, you know, we can use all music, you know, and sort of, and we can put all of this in there and then see what happens. And we kind of jammed it as well. It's like, I've never known sort of before or since, like the idea of just having a load of people all playing samplers at once and stuff, and play beats and playing records and playing keyboards all at once. It was an incredible thing. It was tons of people in the studio. It's probably about 12 people, and all doing stuff in a tiny space. And it kind of sounds like that. I mean, and it's all first ideas on Jack the Tab. It was very much, whatever we thought of within the first few seconds, and then that got down on tape, and then we did that, and then went on to the next track, and that was quite, so it sounds unfinished, but it also sounds kind of brimming with possibility as well. It's kind of both, and I still don't know of many other records that sound like it. It sounds very weird. And so when people have been reading the book and going back to it, they're like, "What the hell is this? It sound like Acid House, and doesn't sound like, it just sounds like this weird kind of sampling record, But at the time, it was just such, because we just well, suddenly we could do this, whereas before you'd either have to come from, avant-garde and tape loops and splicing and that sort of thing, or from very expensive electronics, and we were kind of given the keys to the cupboard basically, which was, I mean, and we took it.
I was listening to you talk recently about the idea that it only takes 100 people to change something culturally.
Yeah.
Were you aware at that point that you were at the forefront of something new?
I think certainly within Acid House, certainly going to Shum, it was, you could tangibly feel the atmosphere, and that there was something in the air. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't think, okay, well, this is the start of, a massive international dance music movement that's going on, decades later. I don't think it was really that, but it sort of felt, yeah, it did feel special, and it did feel, as I say, with those 100 people, it was just the kind of feeling of togetherness and community that you can get within those 100 people, I think is very, very, can be very strong. And also, it doesn't that 100 people can go and create a massive movement in art, music, and culture, or whatever, sport, politics. But also, there's something great about something that is only 100 people. I think there's kind of both ends. There was a piece in The Quietus about the Music Venue Trust, is like saving venues, and they did a picture of the Reading lineup, and it had like took out everyone that hadn't played at a grassroots venue, and just showed that there was only a few things left. And I think that's a very viable point. But also the other point is, you don't have to become massive. You can. There's something, some of the greatest nights I've ever had have been with like 50 or 100 people. And I think that's the thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be a kind of career path. It could also be you and your mates having fun and doing, just doing. I was talking to someone last night about this great cover version band in Cornwall, and they only get together like once every 2 years. They never practice, and they always play the same songs. But people are saying it's one of the best nights out they've ever had. So what it can, it's absolutely, a few people can be catalyst, and I've noticed that certainly within club culture and music culture, again and again. I'm still optimistic that that can happen.
One of the things I enjoyed most about the book is your writing about creativity. I found it was really inspirational. It almost became like a mantra over the pages of operate in the moment, collaborate, be instinctive, and often look to your first idea. And I was wondering how much of that was like a conscious evolution, Richard, or just an accumulation of experience.
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, certainly was an accumulation of spirits, and sometimes with that over years and decades, that you don't really notice it. And the things that I sometimes find, there's things that I think are easy or possible, but I kind of dismiss them because I think, oh well, that's easy, but actually it's not. It's only easy to me. It's not easy to someone else. Someone else might do it in a completely different way, and you kind of realize, well, that's not easy. That's just you being you, and I think so that's kind of unconscious, and that just takes a long time to build up, or not. Maybe it's just innate. So there is that. But then there's also, in the last few years, I've been kind of really thinking about creativity, certainly within the ambient music that I'm making, and what that's for, and what its purpose is. I did this course with this guy T Mango, who it's just about kind of how to get out of creative blocks and how to finish tracks, which I kind of don't, I make records every day, so I haven't really got a problem finishing tracks. But it was a really interesting course, and he kind of led me to lots of other writers, particularly Yeah, this Stephen Pressfield of The War of Art, which is, it's a tiny, slim little volume, and it was just a really good leg up on just thinking, well, yeah, you can do this, and he just talks a lot about resistance. He sort of talks about how that there's certain resistances that will always come up, and they're particularly in right towards the end of a creative process. I get this quite a lot, where you're 98% done. And then there'll be a massive resistance, and then you kind of like, we'll just put it on the shelf. I mean, if I've had albums that haven't come out for 5 years, you're so close to it, but it doesn't quite get there. And I think that he writes a lot about that in the War of Art. I don't know if it'll help everyone, but it really, really helped me. And then in terms of when I came to write the book, I was kind of thinking about those processes rather than just being something that naturally happens. So yeah, I think it's a bit of both, really.
There's a lot of songs throughout the book that never see the light of day.
Yeah.
What's your connection like with that side of your work?
Well, I mean, I think part of the reason there's lots of songs that never see the light of day is that I've been working for, 3, 4 decades, and also that the stories that I tell and the narrative that I kind of weave in the book is very much, what's the interesting narrative? So me sitting in the studio for 30 years making a record, and someone likes it and it comes out, there's not really much story. So there is a definite kind of, it is kind of angled towards calamity and disaster, or just funny stories. And I think, yeah, I think people could read the book and think, God, he just goes from one disaster to another very optimistically, goes leaps into the next one, and doesn't seem to kind of worry about it. But it is the kind of, in terms of the kind of my lifespan, it is, I'd say it's sort of, 90% things go well, but the 10% that doesn't is in the book, basically.
You're perhaps best known for The Grid that you formed with Dave Bell, which enjoyed huge success. And I was thinking about you writing about the nature of success. There's a passage sort of towards the center when you're on Top of the Pops where you talk about the unease of it. You were alluding to a kind of balancing act that you become aware of at that point. And I was wondering how you look back on that.
Think for me, it's always been an issue between kind of culture and commerce, and what how that fits, and what you do, and how far you'll go to become successful, and how that affects your art and your creativity. That's always been an issue, and particularly when kind of going from, I've spent most of my life on independent labels or running independent labels, and then going from that scheme to the major record scheme, way of doing things. It's a very, very different beast, really. So that was, yeah, there was things were speeding up, and we were getting very successful, but we were also being asked to go to Germany to be interviewed by Skinny Their Puppet. So the only kind of way you could get through it was basically laughter and a certain amount of in jokes with the band. But it did, it kind of, particularly after Swamp Thing, that I mean, it was so kind of omnipresent for that one particular summer, and that did kind of kill the band, basically, because it just got too big and too mainstream. Yeah, so it was a bit of an issue there, but it was soon got sorted out by talking to Wigfield in the dressing room, where she just said, "I'm just taking the piss," and I was like, "Oh yeah, you're right. All we need to know, really." It's like the life philosophy, according to Wigfield.
The list of people in the book who you meet and you work with is just endless. Primarily Joe Strummer, but obviously Johnny Marr, Damon Albarn, The Happy Mondays, Peter Gabriel, and so on. But there were two relationships in the book that I wanted to ask you about. The first was Skye Saxon, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about who he was, and I guess about his dedication.
Well, Skye Saxon was, I mean, he had, it was his band, The Seeds, were, they were reasonably successful. They had, there's one point when they're playing at the Hollywood Bowl, and there's a great recording of it, and he's kind of highlighting, really kind of trying to create this kind of flower power revolution in LA, and he's giving away flowers on stage, and they're just, and then the Supremes have been on, or someone, because a couple of other bands have been on, really, and then the Seeds start, and it's just this like dirtiest kind of, they play Trip Maker, it's kind of dirtiest sort of garagey, the blueprint for all garage music, with that kind of fairground swirly organ, and this nasal punk staccato coming out, and Skye was just this incredible punk, really. a real kind of trier. You know, he'd done before, by the time the Seeds had like Pushing Too Hard and started doing albums, you know, he'd had like 10 singles out and on under different names, you know, with under his own name or different assumed band names, a bit like Bowie in a way, just continually just trying to get something going. And you know, and he did, and they did pretty well in America. But I mean, for people in the UK, it's certainly, you know, sort of mid-80s kind of indie kids. They people like Skye Saxon and Rocky Erickson and you know, Nick Drake particularly, and you know, and a ton of others, you know, became these sort of kind of almost mythical beasts, really. You know, they're sort of, you know, completely, they weren't around, and they was the, you know, the 60s felt like, you know, 100 years ago, you know. And so it was it was an amazing thing to, that he came over to London, and me and Phil Smee at BAM Caruso had reissued one of like a greatest hits of Skye's, and it was just amazing to get to meet him, and you know, just his continual ability to just okay, go, hey man, and then want to form a band with like pretty much anyone that he'd meet in the street or in a pub or something, and he would, he just formed these pickup bands and did it for years and years and years. But I mean, you know, to some people he would look like a really borderline kind of acid fried beatnik guy, pretty just only, you know, a couple of levels up from being, you know, destitute really. But on another level, he was just surfing the cosmic waves, you know, just and out there and continually creative and inspired and just wanting to do stuff. And you know, we did vocals with him. It was like this just absolute stream of consciousness coming out. And we'd do another take and it would be completely different. It was like, and another one. And he just was this weird mash of strange sort of stories and chants that he'd do with, as I say, with his vocal range, which is pretty much two notes, you know. So, but the timing, his timing was as good as Sinatra's, I feel. But yeah, just so it was just that, yeah. So the idea of, you know, we worked with him, and when it went horribly wrong, and it made, you know, some amusing chapter in the book. But it was just that dedication that I really thought, well, that's kind of success really, because that's always one kind of success, just continuing to keep going, you know. You know, he's playing, he like headlined the Austin Psych Fest like 2 days before he died, and it's like, well, that's quite good, you know. He's kind of, you know, he's all of his life has been making music pretty much, you know. So I kind of like that. I kind of like that idea of yeah, true believers basically.
Yeah. The other person I wanted to ask you about was Andy Wetherill. He kind of appears in the book as somebody who had a really lasting impact on you.
I think it was kind of, meeting Andrew was very much like finding a kindred spirit amongst lots of other madness going on. So finding Andrew at Shim and Future and these other you know, early acid house parties and clubs was, you know, most of the people there were soul boys really, had come from kind of Case the Weekenders or from earlier kind of London clubbing, which was, you know, much more West End and kind of dressing up. It was much more elitist. It's quite shocking. People were like, you know, the sort of pre-acid house, people were like really rude to each other in clubs. It was quite a combative thing. I mean, there were absolute, you know, there was wars going on between different sets of queens at the time. There were actual physical fights and stuff. It wasn't particularly nice, you know. You could have fun, but it was a bit, it wasn't very, it was everyone for themselves. It was quite, you know, it was quite right wing in a way. It had that element, and just, you know, wanting to be a star, dressing up, very much the Studio 54 end of things rather than the loft end of things. So me, you know, so you had those people, and then you know, a big influx of people from Soul Weekenders and football. So you know, I kind of don't really fit into any of those categories. It was really refreshing to meet Andrew, who was coming, you know, that knew was coming the same kind of way as me. So through Peel and through you know, Weird Records and electronic music and you know, kind of outsider stuff really. You know, we kind of recognize each other, I think, a bit. I wasn't particularly close to him. I mean, I kind of, you know, I sort of was reasonably close to him, but I wasn't like one of, you know, I didn't wasn't one of his best mates or anything. But you know, we'd always nod to each other when we played together, or he'd always, having Andrew say, "Oh, one of my tunes," he played it out and liked it. To me, that was it. That was the absolute pinnacle. That was like getting it on John Peel or something. It was like, that's, and I still miss that. I still miss thinking, I still sit in the studio, make records and think, what would Andrew think? I mean, that absolutely, that's never going to stop. He's had incredible integrity, and I think for me, that's been something that I've really looked up to for, people out here. And, as I say in the book, when I met Johnny Marr, I had the sort of same feeling. He just had such a grace about him. And it was like, I was like, right, oh, this is the way you should behave. This is how to operate and communicate with other people. And it's, yeah. So there's been lots of people within music that have really helped me kind of, realize, there's different ways to go about it. One of them can end up in the sort of slippery slope of slidey pole of commerciality, and the other one can be being, more of a decent person, and the tussle between them is certainly something that goes through the book.
Has the experience of writing the memoir settled with you yet, Richard?
No. It's been really weird, and it's sort of I mean, because it's, any writer will tell you, I'm sure you feel the same. You write something and you just have just a complete just roller coaster of emotions. It's like, oh, this is really shit, or I think this is great, or and anything in between. It didn't really hit me until I did the audiobook, and that's when I really realized, oh, hold on a minute, this is me I'm talking about. It was kind of like, and so then it was like, God, there's loads of quite kind of naked things in there. And like, when my dad died and things, I mean, that was really tricky. It took a long time to do that bit in the audiobook, and it's like I was just crying my eyes out. It was really where, which what didn't happen when I read it, when I wrote it. And it wasn't, I did, kind of was affected, but wasn't as much. And so I think that the beginning of the kind of catharsis of writing only happened when I started to speak it out in doing the audiobook. I don't know what any shrink would say about that. But since that, I mean, just the book tour, the ongoing book tour has just been really bizarre. It feels like, we did one at the Social with, and there was people there from like 40 years of different parts of my life. And Matthew Clayton, who was hosting, said, "Anyone here know Richard?" And then like the entire audience put their hands up. And it was just straight, it was just such a weird, it felt like, it really felt like I was attending my own funeral. It really did. I can tell it's kind of going in deep, but I don't really know. I don't know what's next, or if I'll be at peace with it. But I'm kind of it does feel very positive though.
Strange Things Are Happening is published by White Rabbit Books and is a huge recommend. Big thanks go to Richard, and we'll be back next week with Vida Adamczewski and Catherine Prasivka. So until then, big love.